facile and cliched occurs. You leave deeply annoyed and unsatisfied, failing to notice that you were fully engaged and enjoying the movie almost the whole time you were in the theater. The present can change the past, and the future can change the present. When you are remembering the past as well, you remember some parts of it and forget others. You have clear memories of some things that happened, but not others of potentially equal import, just as in the present you are aware of some aspects of your surroundings and unconscious of others. You categorize your experience, grouping some elements together and separating them from the rest. There is a mysterious arbitrariness about all of this. You don't form a comprehensive, objective record. You can't. You just don't know enough. You just can't perceive enough. You're not objective either. You're alive. You're subjective. You have vested interests, at least in yourself, at least usually. What exactly should be included in the story? Where exactly is the border between events? The sexual abuse of children is distressingly common. However, it's not as common as poorly trained psychotherapists think, and it also does not always produce terribly damaged adults. People vary in their resilience. An event that will wipe one person out can be shrugged off by another. But therapists with a little second-hand knowledge of Freud often axiomatically assume that a distressed adult in their practice must have been subject to childhood sexual abuse. Why else would they be distressed? So they dig and infer and intimate and suggest and overreact and bias and tilt. They exaggerate the importance of some events and downplay the importance of others. They trim the facts to fit their theory, and they convince their clients that they were sexually abused, if they could only remember. And then the clients start to remember. And then they start to accuse. Sometimes what they remember never happened, and the people accused are innocent. The good news? At least the therapist's theory remains intact. That's good for the therapist. But there's no shortage of collateral damage. However, people are often willing to produce a lot of collateral damage if they can retain their theory. I knew about all this when Miss S. came to talk to me about her sexual experiences. When she recounted her trips to the singles bars and their recurring aftermath, I thought a bunch of things at once. I thought, you're so vague and so non-existent. You're a denizen of chaos and the underworld. You are going 10 different places at the same time. Anyone can take you by the hand and guide you down the road of their choosing. After all, if you're not the leading man in your own drama, you're a bit player in someone else's, and you might well be assigned to play a dismal, lonely, and tragic part. After Miss S. recounted her story, we sat there. I thought, you have normal sexual desires. You're extremely lonely. You're unfulfilled sexually. You're afraid of men and ignorant of the world and know nothing of yourself. You wander around like an accident waiting to happen. And the accident happens, and that's your life. I thought, part of you wants to be taken. Part of you wants to be a child. You were abused by your brothers and ignored by your father, and so part of you wants revenge upon men. Part of you is guilty. Another part is ashamed. Another part is thrilled and excited. Who are you? What did you do? What happened? What was the objective truth? There was no way of knowing the objective truth, and there never would be. There was no objective observer, and there never would be. There was no complete and accurate story. Such a thing did not and could not exist. There were and are only partial accounts and fragmentary viewpoints. But some are still better than others. Memory is not a description of the objective past. Memory is a tool. Memory is the past's guide to the future. If you remember that something bad happened, and you can figure out why, then you can try to avoid that bad thing happening again. That's the purpose of memory. It's not to remember the past. It's to stop the same damn thing from happening over and over. I thought, I could simplify Miss S's life. I could say that her suspicions of rape were fully justified, and that her doubt about the events was nothing but additional evidence of her thorough and long-term victimization. I could insist that her sexual partners had a legal obligation to ensure that she was not too impaired by alcohol to give consent. I could tell her that she had indisputably been subject to violent and illicit acts unless she had consented to each sexual move explicitly and verbally. I could tell her that she was an innocent victim. I could have told her all that, and it would have been true, and she would have accepted it as true and remembered it for the rest of her life. She would have been a new person with a new history and a new destiny. But I also thought, I could tell Miss S that she is a walking disaster. I could tell her that she wanders into a bar like a courtesan in a coma, that she is a danger to herself and others, that she needs to wake up, and that if she goes to singles bars and drinks too much and is taken home and has rough, violent sex, or even tender, caring sex, then what the hell does she expect? In other words, I could have told her, in more philosophical terms, that she was Nietzsche's pale criminal, the person who at one moment dares to break the sacred law and at the next shrinks from paying the price. And that would have been true, too, and she would have accepted it as such and remembered it. If I had been the adherent of a left-wing social justice ideology, I would have told her the first story. If I had been the adherent of a conservative ideology, I would have told her the second. And her responses, after having been told either the first or second story, would have proved to my satisfaction and hers that the story I had told her was true, completely, irrefutably true. And that would have been advice. Figure it out for yourself. I decided instead to listen. I have learned not to steal my clients' problems from them. I don't want to be the redeeming hero or the deus ex machina, not in someone else's story. I don't want their lives. So I asked her to tell me what she thought, and I listened. She talked a lot. When we were finished, she still didn't know if she had been raped, and neither did I. Life is very complicated. Sometimes you have to change the way you understand everything to properly understand a single something. Was I raped? Can be a very complicated question. The mere fact that the question would present itself in that form indicates the existence of infinite layers of complexity, to say nothing of five times. There are a myriad of questions hidden inside, was I raped? What is rape? What is consent? What constitutes appropriate sexual caution? How should a person defend herself? Where does the fault lie? Was I raped? Is a hydra? If you cut off the head of a hydra, seven more grow. That's life. Miss S would have had to talk for 20 years to figure out whether she had been raped, and someone would have had to be there to listen. I started the process, but circumstances made it impossible for me to finish. She left therapy with me, only somewhat less ill-formed and vague than when she first met me. But at least she didn't leave as the living embodiment of my damned ideology. The people I listen to need to talk, because that's how people think. People need to think, otherwise they wander blindly into pits. When people think, they simulate the world and plan how to act in it. If they do a good job of simulating, they can figure out what stupid things they shouldn't do. Then they cannot do them. Then they don't have to suffer the consequences. That's the purpose of thinking. But we can't do it alone. We simulate the world and plan our actions in it. Only human beings do this. That's how brilliant we are. We make little avatars of ourselves. We place those avatars in fictional worlds. Then we watch what happens. If our avatar thrives, Then we act like he does in the real world. Then we thrive, we hope. If our avatar fails, we don't go there, if we have any sense. We let him die in the fictional world so that we don't have to really die in the present. Imagine two children talking. The younger one says, "Wouldn't it be fun to climb up on the roof?" He has just placed a little avatar of himself in a fictional world. But his older sister objects. She chimes in. "That's stupid," she says. "What if you fall off the roof? What if Dad catches you?" The younger child can then modify the original simulation, draw the appropriate conclusion, and let the whole fictional world wither on the vine. Or not. Maybe the risk is worth it. But at least now it can be factored in. The fictional world is a bit more complete, and the avatar a bit wiser. People think they think, but it's not true. It's mostly self-criticism that passes for thinking. True thinking is rare, just like true listening. Thinking is listening to yourself. It's difficult. To think, you have to be at least two people at the same time. Then you have to let those people disagree. Thinking is an internal dialogue between two or more different views of the world. Viewpoint one is an avatar in a simulated world. It has its own representations of past, present, and future, and its own ideas about how to act. So do viewpoints two, and three, and four. Thinking is the process by which these internal avatars imagine and articulate their worlds to one another. You can't set straw men against one another when you're thinking either, because then you're not thinking. You're rationalizing post hoc. You're matching what you want against a weak opponent so that you don't have to change your mind. You're propagandizing. You're using doublespeak. You're using your conclusions to justify your proofs. You're hiding from the truth. True thinking is complex and demanding. It requires you to be articulate speaker and careful, judicious listener at the same time. It involves conflict. So you have to tolerate conflict. Conflict involves negotiation and compromise. So you have to learn to give and take and to modify your premises and adjust your thoughts, even your perceptions of the world. Sometimes it results in the defeat and elimination of one or more internal avatar. They don't like to be defeated or eliminated either. They're hard to build. They're valuable. They're alive. They like to stay alive. They'll fight to stay alive. You better listen to them. If you don't, they'll go underground and turn into devils and torture you. In consequence, thinking is emotionally painful as well as physiologically demanding, more so than anything else, except not thinking. But you have to be very articulate and sophisticated to have all of this occur inside your own head. What are you to do, then, if you aren't very good at thinking, at being two people at one time? That's easy. You talk, but you need someone to listen. A listening person is your collaborator and your opponent. A listening person tests your talking and your thinking without having to say anything. A listening person is a representative of common humanity. He stands for the crowd. Now, the crowd is by no means always right, but it's commonly right. It's typically right. If you say something that takes everyone aback, therefore, you should reconsider what you said. I say that knowing full well that controversial opinions are sometimes correct, sometimes so much so that the crowd will perish if it refuses to listen. It is for this reason, among others, that the individual is morally obliged to stand up and tell the truth of his or her own experience. But something new and radical is still almost always wrong. You need good, even great reasons to ignore or defy general public opinion. That's your culture. It's a mighty oak. You perch on one of its branches. If the branch breaks, it's a long way down, farther, perhaps, than you think. If you're reading this book, there's a strong probability that you're a privileged person. You can read. You have time to read. You're perched high in the clouds. It took untold generations to get you where you are. A little gratitude might be in order. If you're going to insist on bending the world to your way, you better have your reasons. If you're going to stand your ground, you better have your reasons. You better have thought them through. You might otherwise be in for a very hard landing. You should do what other people do, unless you have a very good reason not to. If you're in a rut, at least you know that other people have traveled that path. Out of the rut is too often off the road. And in the desert that awaits off the road, there are highwaymen and monsters. So speaks wisdom. A listening person. A listening person can reflect the crowd. He can do that without talking. He can do that merely by letting the talking person listen to himself. That is what Freud recommended. He had his patients lay on a couch, look at the ceiling, let their minds wander, and say whatever wandered in. That's his method of free association. That's the way the Freudian psychoanalyst avoids transferring his or her own personal biases and opinions into the internal landscape of the patient. It was for such reasons that Freud did not face his patients. He did not want their spontaneous meditations to be altered by his emotional expressions, no matter how slight. He was properly concerned that his own opinions, and worse, his own unresolved problems, would find themselves uncontrollably reflected in his responses and reactions, conscious and unconscious alike. He was afraid that he would, in such a manner, detrimentally affect the development of his patients. It was for such reasons as well that Freud insisted that psychoanalysts be analyzed themselves. He wanted those who practiced his method to uncover and eliminate some of their own worst blind spots and prejudices, so they would not practice corruptly. Freud had a point. He was, after all, a genius. You can tell that because people still hate him. But there are disadvantages to the detached and somewhat distant approach recommended by Freud. Many of those who seek therapy desire and need a closer, more personal relationship, although that also has its dangers. This is in part why I have opted in my practice for the conversation instead of the Freudian method, as have most clinical psychologists. It can be worthwhile for my clients to see my reactions. To protect them from the undue influence that might produce, I attempt to set my aim properly so that my responses emerge from the appropriate motivation. I do what I can to want the best for them, whatever that might be. I do my best to want the best, period, as well, because that is part of wanting the best for my clients. I try to clear my mind and to leave my own concerns aside. That way, I am concentrating on what is best for my clients, while I am simultaneously alert to any cues that I might be misunderstanding what that best is. That's something that has to be negotiated, not assumed on my part. It's something that has to be managed very carefully to mitigate the risks of close personal interaction. My clients talk. I listen. Sometimes I respond. Often the response is subtle. It's not even verbal. My clients and I face each other. We make eye contact. We can see each other's expressions. They can observe the effects of their words on me. And I can observe the effects of mine on them. They can respond to my responses. A client of mine might say, "I hate my wife." It's out there, once said. It's hanging in the air. It has emerged from the underworld, materialized from chaos, and manifested itself. It is perceptible and concrete, and no longer easily ignored. It's become real. The speaker is even startled himself. He sees the same thing reflected in my eyes. He notes that and continues on the road to sanity. "Hold it," he says, "back up. That's too harsh. Sometimes I hate my wife. I hate her when she won't tell me what she wants. My mom did that all the time, too. It drove Dad crazy. It drove all of us crazy, to tell you the truth. It even drove Mum crazy. She was a nice person, but she was very resentful. Well, at least my wife isn't as bad as my mother. Not at all. Wait, I guess my wife is actually pretty good at telling me what she wants. But I get really bothered when she doesn't, because Mum tortured us all half to death being a martyr. That really affected me. Maybe I overreact now, when it happens even a bit. Hey, I'm acting just like Dad did when Mum upset him. That isn't me. That doesn't have anything to do with my wife. I better let her know. I observe from all this that my client had failed previously to properly distinguish his wife from his mother. And I see that he was possessed unconsciously by the spirit of his father. He sees all of that, too. Now he is a bit more differentiated, a bit less an uncarved block, a bit less hidden in the fog. He has sewed up a small tear in the fabric of his culture. He says, "That was a good session, Dr. Peterson." I nod. "You can be pretty smart if you can just shut up." I'm a collaborator and opponent, even when I'm not talking. I can't help it. My expressions broadcast my response, even when they're subtle. So I'm communicating, as Freud so rightly stressed, even when silent. But I also talk in my clinical sessions. How do I know when to say something? First, as I said, I put myself in the proper frame of mind. I aim properly. I want things to be better. My mind orients itself, given this goal. It tries to produce responses to the therapeutic dialogue that furthers that aim. I watch what happens internally. I reveal my responses. That's the first rule. Sometimes, for example, a client will say something, and a thought will occur to me or a fantasy flit through my mind. Frequently, it's about something that was said by the same client earlier that day or during a previous session. Then I tell my client that thought or fantasy. Disinterestedly, I say, "You said this, and I noticed that I then became aware of this." Then we discuss it. We try to determine the relevance of meaning of my reaction. Sometimes, perhaps, it's about me. That was Freud's point. But sometimes it is just the reaction of a detached but positively inclined human being to a personally revealing statement by another human being. It's meaningful, sometimes even corrective. Sometimes, however, it's me that gets corrected. You have to get along with other people. A therapist is one of those other people. A good therapist will tell you the truth about what he thinks. That is not the same thing as telling you that what he thinks is the truth. Then at least you have the honest opinion of at least one person. That's not so easy to get. That's not nothing. That's key to the psychotherapeutic process. Two people tell each other the truth, and both listen. How should you listen? Carl Rogers, one of the 20th century's great psychotherapists, knew something about listening. He wrote, "The great majority of us cannot listen. We find ourselves compelled to evaluate, because listening is too dangerous. The first requirement is courage, and we do not always have it." He knew that listening could transform people. On that, Rogers commented, "Some of you may be feeling that you listen well to people, and that you have never seen such results. The chances are very great indeed that your listening has not been of the type I have described." He suggested that his readers conduct a short experiment when they next found themselves in a dispute. Stop the discussion for a moment and institute this rule. Each person can speak up for himself only after he has first restated the ideas and feelings of the previous speaker accurately and to that speaker's satisfaction. I have found this technique very useful in my private life and in my practice. I routinely summarize what people have said to me and ask them if I've understood properly. Sometimes they accept my summary. Sometimes I'm offered a small correction. Now and then I'm wrong completely. All of that is good to know. There are several primary advantages to this process of summary. The first advantage is that I genuinely come to understand what the person is saying. Of this, Rogers notes, "Sounds simple, doesn't it? But if you try it, you will discover it is one of the most difficult things you've ever tried to do. If you really understand a person in this way, if you are willing to enter his private world and see the way life appears to him, you run the risk of being changed yourself. You might see it his way. You might find yourself influenced in your attitudes or personality. This risk of being changed is one of the most frightening prospects most of us can face." More salutary words have rarely been written. The second advantage to the act of summary is that it aids the person in consolidation and utility of memory. Consider the following situation. A client in my practice recounts a long, meandering, emotion-laden account of a difficult period in his or her life. We summarize back and forth. The account becomes shorter. It is now summed up in the client's memory, and in mine, in the form we discussed. It is now a different memory in many ways. With luck, a better memory. It is now less weighty. It has been distilled, reduced to the gist. We have extracted the moral of the story. It becomes a description of the cause and the result of what happened, formulated such that repetition of the tragedy and pain becomes less likely in the future. This is what happened. This is why. This is what I have to do to avoid such things from now on. That's a successful memory. That's the purpose of memory. You remember the past not so that it is accurately recorded to say it again, but so that you are prepared for the future. The third advantage to employing the Rogerian method is the difficulty it poses to the careless construction of straw man arguments. When someone opposes you, it is very tempting to oversimplify, parody, or distort his or her position. This is a counterproductive game, designed both to harm the dissenter and to unjustly raise your personal status. By contrast, if you are called upon to summarize someone's position so that the speaking person agrees with that summary, you may have to state the argument even more clearly and succinctly than the speaker has even yet managed. If you first give the devil his due, looking at his arguments from his perspective, you can, number one, find the value in them and learn something in the process, or number two, hone your positions against them, if you still believe they are wrong, and strengthen your arguments further against challenge. This will make you much stronger. Then you will no longer have to misrepresent your opponent's position, and may well have bridged at least part of the gap between the two of you. You will also be much better at withstanding your own doubts. Sometimes it takes a long time to figure out what someone genuinely means when they are talking. This is because often they are articulating their ideas for the first time. They can't do it without wandering down blind alleys or making contradictory or even nonsensical claims. This is partly because talking and thinking is often more about forgetting than about remembering. To discuss an event, particularly something emotional like a death or serious illness, is to slowly choose what to leave behind. To begin, however, much that is not necessary must be put into words. The emotion-laden speaker must recount the whole experience in detail. Only then can the central narrative, cause and consequence, come into focus or consolidate itself. Only then can the moral of the story be derived. Imagine that someone holds a stack of $100 bills, some of which are counterfeit. All the bills might have to be spread on a table so that each can be seen and any differences noted before the genuine can be distinguished from the false. This is the sort of methodical approach you have to take when really listening to someone trying to solve a problem or communicate something important. If upon learning that some of the bills are counterfeit, you too casually dismiss all of them, as you would if you were in a hurry or otherwise unwilling to put in the effort, the person will never learn to separate wheat from chaff. If you listen instead without premature judgment, people will generally tell you everything they are thinking, and with very little deceit. People will tell you the most amazing, absurd, interesting things. Very few of your conversations will be boring. You can, in fact, tell whether or not you are actually listening in this manner. If the conversation is boring, you probably aren't. Primate dominance hierarchy maneuvers and wit. Not all talking is thinking, nor does all listening foster transformation. There are other motives for both, some of which produce much less valuable, counterproductive, and even dangerous outcomes. There is the conversation, for example, where one participant is speaking merely to establish or confirm his place in the dominance hierarchy. One person begins by telling a story about some interesting occurrence, recent or past, that involved something good, bad, or surprising enough to make the listening worthwhile. The other person, now concerned with his or her potentially substandard status as less interesting individual, immediately thinks of something better, worse, or more surprising to relate. This isn't one of those situations where two conversational participants are genuinely playing off each other, riffing on the same themes, for the mutual enjoyment of both and everyone else. This is jockeying for position, pure and simple. You can tell when one of those conversations is occurring. They are accompanied by a feeling of embarrassment among speakers and listeners alike, all who know that something false and exaggerated has just been said. There is another closely allied form of conversation where neither speaker is listening in the least to the other. Instead, each is using the time occupied by the current speaker to conjure up what he or she will say next, which will often be something off-topic because the person anxiously waiting to speak has not been listening. This can and will bring the whole conversational train to a shuddering halt. At this point, it is usual for those who were on board during the crash to remain silent and look occasionally and in a somewhat embarrassed manner at each other until everyone leaves, or someone thinks of something witty and puts Humpty Dumpty together again. Then there is the conversation where one participant is trying to attain victory for his point of view. This is yet another variant of the dominance hierarchy conversation. During such a conversation, which often tends towards the ideological, the speaker endeavors to, number one, denigrate or ridicule the viewpoint of anyone holding a contrary position, number two, use selective evidence while doing so, and, finally, number three, impress the listeners, many of whom are already occupying the same ideological space, with the validity of his assertions. The goal is to gain support for a comprehensive, unitary, oversimplified worldview. Thus, the purpose of the conversation is to make the case that not thinking is the correct tack. The person who is speaking in this manner believes that winning the argument makes him right, and that doing so necessarily validates the assumption structure of the dominance hierarchy he most identifies with. This is often, and unsurprisingly, the hierarchy within which he has achieved the most success, or the one with which he is most temperamentally aligned. Almost all discussions involving politics or economics unfold in this manner, with each participant attempting to justify fixed, a priori positions, instead of trying to learn something or to adopt a different frame, even for the novelty. It is for this reason that conservatives and liberals alike believe their positions to be self-evident, particularly as they become more extreme. Given certain temperamentally based assumptions, a predictable conclusion emerges, but only when you ignore the fact that the assumptions themselves are mutable. These conversations are very different from the listening type. When a genuine listening conversation is taking place, one person at a time has the floor, and everyone else is listening. The person speaking is granted the opportunity to seriously discuss some event, usually unhappy or even tragic. Everyone else responds sympathetically. These conversations are important because the speaker is organizing the troublesome event in his or her mind while recounting the story. The fact is important enough to bear repeating. People organize their brains with conversation. If they don't have anyone to tell their story to, they lose their minds. Like hoarders, they cannot unclutter themselves. The input of the community is required for the integrity of the individual psyche. To put it another way, it takes a village to organize a mind. Much of what we consider healthy mental function is the result of our ability to use the reactions of others to keep our complex selves functional. We outsource the problem of our sanity. This is why it is the fundamental responsibility of parents to render their children socially acceptable. If a person's behavior is such that other people can tolerate him, then all he has to do is place himself in a social context. Then people will indicate by being interested in or bored by what he says, or laughing or not laughing at his jokes, or teasing or ridiculing, or even by lifting an eyebrow, whether his actions and statements are what they should be. Everyone is always broadcasting to everyone else their desire to encounter the ideal. We punish and reward each other precisely to the degree that each of us behaves in keeping with that desire, except, of course, when we are looking for trouble. The sympathetic responses offered during a genuine conversation indicate that the teller is valued and that the story being told is important, serious, deserving of consideration, and understandable. Men and women often misunderstand each other when these conversations are focused on a specified problem. Men are often accused of wanting to fix things too early on in a discussion. This frustrates men who like to solve problems and to do it efficiently, and who are in fact called upon frequently by women for precisely that purpose. It might be easier for my male readers to understand why this does not work, however, if they could realize and then remember that before a problem can be solved, it must be formulated precisely. Women are often intent on formulating the problem when they are discussing something, and they need to be listened to, even questioned, to help ensure clarity in the formulation. Then, whatever problem is left, if any, can be helpfully solved. It should also be noted first that too early problem solving may also merely indicate a desire to escape from the effort of the problem formulating conversation. Another conversational variant is the lecture. A lecture is, somewhat surprisingly, a conversation. The lecturer speaks, but the audience communicates with him or her nonverbally. A surprising amount of human interaction, much of the delivery of emotional information, for example, takes place in this manner, through postural display and facial emotion, as we noted in our discussion of Freud. A good lecturer is not only delivering facts, which is perhaps the least important part of a lecture, but also telling stories about those facts, pitching them precisely to the level of the audience's comprehension, gauging that by the interest they are showing. The story he or she is telling conveys to the members of the audience not only what the facts are, but why they are relevant, why it is important to know certain things about which they are currently ignorant. To demonstrate the importance of some set of facts is to tell those audience members how such knowledge could change their behavior or influence the way they interpret the world, so that they will now be able to avoid some obstacles and progress more rapidly to some better goals. A good lecturer is thus talking with and not at or even to his or her listeners. To manage this, the lecturer needs to be closely attending to the audience's every move, gesture, and sound. Perversely, this cannot be done by watching the audience as such. A good lecturer speaks directly to and watches the response of single identifiable people instead of doing something cliched, such as presenting a talk to an audience. Everything about that phrase is wrong. You don't present, you talk. There is no such thing as a talk unless it's canned, and it shouldn't be. There is also no audience. There are individuals who need to be included in the conversation. A well-practiced and competent public speaker addresses a single identifiable person, watches that individual nod, shake his head, frown, or look confused, and responds appropriately and directly to those gestures and expressions. Then, after a few phrases, rounding out some idea, he switches to another audience member and does the same thing. In this manner, he infers and reacts to the attitude of the entire group, insofar as such a thing exists. There are still other conversations that work primarily as demonstrations of wit. These also have a dominance element, but the goal is to be the most entertaining speaker, which is an accomplishment that everyone participating will also enjoy. The purpose of these conversations, as a witty friend of mine once observed, was to say anything that was either true or funny. As truth and humor are often close allies, that combination worked fine. I think that this might be the intelligent blue-collar workers conversation. I participated in many fine bouts of sarcasm, satire, insult, and generally over-the-top comedic exchange among people I grew up with in northern Alberta, and, later, among some Navy SEALs I met in California, who were friends of an author I know who writes somewhat horrifying popular fiction. They were all perfectly happy to say anything, no matter how appalling, as long as it was funny. I attended this writer's 40th birthday celebration not too long ago in L.A. He had invited one of the aforementioned SEALs. A few months beforehand, however, his wife had been diagnosed with a serious medical condition necessitating brain surgery. He called up his SEAL friend, informed him of the circumstances, and indicated that the event might have to be canceled. "You think you guys have a problem," responded his friend. "I just bought non-refundable airline tickets to your party." It's not clear what percentage of the world's population would find that response amusing. I retold the story recently to a group of newer acquaintances, and they were more shocked and appalled than amused. I tried to defend the joke as an indication of the SEAL's respect for the couple's ability to withstand and transcend tragedy, but I wasn't particularly successful. Nonetheless, I believe that he did intend exactly that respect, and I think he was terrifyingly witty. His joke was daring, anarchic to the point of recklessness, which is exactly the point where serious funny occurs. My friend and his wife recognized the compliment. They saw that their friend knew they were tough enough to withstand that level of, well, let's call it competitive humor. It was a test of character, which they passed with flying colors. I found that such conversations occurred less and less frequently as I moved from university to university up the educational and social ladder. Maybe it wasn't a class thing, although I have my suspicions it was. Maybe it's just that I'm older, or that the friends a person makes later in life after adolescence lack the insane competitive closeness and perverse playfulness of those early tribal bonds. When I went back up north to my hometown for my 50th birthday party, however, my old friends made me laugh so hard I had to duck into a different room several times to catch my breath. Those conversations are the most fun, and I miss them. You have to keep up or risk severe humiliation, but there's nothing more rewarding than topping the last comedian's story, joke, insult, or curse. Only one rule really applies. Do not be boring, although it is also very bad form to actually put someone down when you are only pretending to put them down. Conversation on the way. The final type of conversation, akin to listening, is a form of mutual exploration. It requires true reciprocity on the part of those listening and speaking. It allows all participants to express and organize their thoughts. A conversation of mutual exploration has a topic, generally complex, of genuine interest to the participants. Everyone participating is trying to solve a problem instead of insisting on the a priori validity of their own positions. All are acting on the premise that they have something to learn. This kind of conversation constitutes active philosophy, the highest form of thought, and the best preparation for proper living. The people involved in such a conversation must be discussing ideas they genuinely use to structure their perceptions and guide their actions and words. They must be existentially involved with their philosophy. That is, they must be living it, not merely believing or understanding it. They also must have inverted, at least temporarily, the typical human preference for order over chaos. And I don't mean the chaos typical of mindless antisocial rebellion. Other conversational types, except for the listening type, all attempt to buttress some existing order. The conversation of mutual exploration, by contrast, requires people who have decided that the unknown makes a better friend than the known. You already know what you know, after all, and unless your life is perfect, what you know is not enough. You remain threatened by disease and self-deception and unhappiness and malevolence and betrayal and corruption and pain and limitation. You are subject to all these things in the final analysis because you are just too ignorant to protect yourself. If you just knew enough, you could be healthier and more honest. You would suffer less. You could recognize, resist, and even triumph over malevolence and evil. You would neither betray a friend nor deal falsely and deceitfully in business, politics, or love. However, your current knowledge has neither made you perfect nor kept you safe. So, it is insufficient. By definition, radically, fatally insufficient. You must accept this before you can converse philosophically, instead of convincing, oppressing, dominating, or even amusing. You must accept this before you can tolerate a conversation where the word that eternally mediates between order and chaos is operating, psychologically speaking. To have this kind of conversation, it is necessary to respect the personal experience of your conversational partners. You must assume that they have reached careful, thoughtful, genuine conclusions. And, perhaps, they must have done the work that justifies this assumption. You must believe that if they shared their conclusions with you, you could bypass at least some of the pain of personally learning the same things, as learning from the experience of others can be quicker and much less dangerous. You must meditate, too, instead of strategizing towards victory. If you fail or refuse to do so, then you merely and automatically repeat what you already believe, seeking its validation and insisting on its rightness. But if you are meditating as you converse, then you listen to the other person and say the new and original things that can rise from deep within of their own accord. It's as if you are listening to yourself during such a conversation, just as you are listening to the other person. You are describing how you are responding to the new information imparted by the speaker. You are reporting what that information has done to you, what new things it made appear within you, how it has changed your presuppositions, how it has made you think of new questions. You tell the speaker these things directly. Then they have the same effect on him. In this manner, you both move towards somewhere newer and broader and better. You both change. As you let your old presuppositions die, as you shed your skins and emerge renewed. A conversation such as this is one where it is the desire for truth itself on the part of both participants that is truly listening and speaking. That's why it's engaging, vital, interesting, and meaningful. That sense of meaning is a signal from the deep, ancient parts of your being. You're where you should be, with one foot in order and the other tentatively extended into chaos and the unknown. You're immersed in the Tao, following the great way of life. There, you're stable enough to be secure, but flexible enough to transform. There, you're allowing new information to inform you, to permeate your stability, to repair and improve its structure and expand its domain. There, the constituent elements of your being can find their more elegant formation. A conversation like that places you in the same place that listening to great music places you, and for much the same reason. A conversation like that puts you in the realm where souls connect, and that's a real place. It leaves you thinking, that was really worthwhile. We really got to know each other. The masks came off and the searchers were revealed. So, listen to yourself and to those with whom you are speaking. Your wisdom then consists not of the knowledge you already have, but of the continual search for knowledge, which is the highest form of wisdom. It is for this reason that the priestess of the Delphic Oracle in ancient Greece spoke most highly of Socrates, who always sought the truth. She described him as the wisest living man, because he knew that what he knew was nothing. Assume that the person you are listening to might know something you don't. Rule 10. Be precise in your speech. Why is my laptop obsolete? What do you see when you look at a computer? At your own laptop, more precisely. You see a flat, thin, gray and black box. Less evidently, you see something to type on and look at. Nonetheless, even with the second perceptions included, what you are seeing is hardly the computer at all. That gray and black box happens to be a computer right now, right here and now, and maybe even an expensive computer. Nevertheless, it will soon be something so unlike a computer that it will be difficult even to give away. We will all discard our laptops within the next 5 years, even though they may still work perfectly, even though the screens, keyboards, mice, and internet connections may still flawlessly perform their tasks. 50 years from now, early 21st century laptops will be oddities, like the brass scientific tools of the late 19th century. The latter now appear more like the arcane accoutrements of alchemy, designed to measure phenomena whose existence we no longer even recognize. How can high-tech machines, each possessing more computing power than the entire Apollo space program, lose their value in such a short period of time? How can they transform so quickly from exciting, useful, and status-enhancing machines to complex pieces of junk? It's because of the nature of our perceptions themselves, and the oft-invisible interaction between those perceptions and the underlying complexity of the world. Your laptop is a note in a symphony currently being played by an orchestra of incalculable size. It's a very small part of a much greater whole. Most of its capacity resides beyond its hard shell. It maintains its function only because a vast array of other technologies are currently and harmoniously at play. It is fed, for example, by a power grid whose function is invisibly dependent on the stability of a myriad of complex physical, biological, economic, and interpersonal systems. The factories that make its parts are still in operation. The operating system that enables its function is based on those parts and not on others yet to be created. Its video hardware runs the technology expected by the creative people who post their content on the web. Your laptop is in communication with a certain, specified ecosystem of other devices and web servers. And, finally, all this is made possible by an even less visible element, the social contract of trust. The interconnected and fundamentally honest political and economic systems that make the reliable electrical grid a reality. This interdependency of part on whole, invisible in systems that work, becomes starkly evident in systems that don't. The higher order surrounding systems that enable personal computing hardly exist at all in corrupt third world countries. So that the power lines, electrical switches, outlets, and all the other entities so hopefully and concretely indicative of such a grid are absent or compromised, and in fact make little contribution to the practical delivery of electricity to people's homes and factories. This makes perceiving the electronic and other devices that electricity theoretically enables as separate functional units frustrating at minimum and impossible at worst. This is partly because of technical insufficiency. The systems simply don't work. But it is also in no small part because of the lack of trust characteristic of systemically corrupt societies. To put it another way, what you perceive as your computer is like a single leaf on a tree in a forest, or even more accurately, like your fingers rubbing briefly across that leaf. A single leaf can be plucked from a branch. It can be perceived briefly as a single self-contained entity, but that perception misleads more than clarifies. In a few weeks, the leaf will crumble and dissolve. It would not have been there at all without the tree. It cannot continue to exist in the absence of the tree. This is the position of our laptops in relation to the world. So much of what they are resides outside their boundaries that the screen devices we hold on our laps can only maintain their computer-like facade for a few short years. Almost everything we see and hold is like that, although often not so evidently. Tools, obstacles, and extension into the world. We assume that we see objects or things when we look at the world, but that's not really how it is. Our evolved perceptual systems transform the interconnected, complex, multi-level world that we inhabit, not so much into things per se, as into useful things, or their nemesis, things that get in the way. This is the necessary, practical reduction of the world. This is the transformation of the near-infinite complexity of things through the narrow specification of our purpose. This is how precision makes the world sensibly manifest. That is not at all the same as perceiving objects. We don't see valueless entities and then attribute meaning to them. We perceive the meaning directly. We see floors to walk on and doors to duck through and chairs to sit on. It's for this reason that a beanbag and a stump both fall into the latter category, despite having little objectively in common. We see rocks because we can throw them, and clouds because they can rain on us, and apples to eat, and the automobiles of other people to get in our way and annoy us. We see tools and obstacles, not objects or things. Furthermore, we see tools and obstacles at the handy level of analysis that makes them most useful or dangerous given our needs, abilities, and perceptual limitations. The world reveals itself to us as something to utilize and something to navigate through, not as something that merely is. We see the faces of the people we are talking to because we need to communicate with those people and cooperate with them. We don't see their microcosmic substructures, their cells, or the subcellular organelles, molecules, and atoms that make up those cells. We don't see as well the macrocosm that surrounds them, the family members and friends that make up their immediate social circles, the economies they are embedded within, or the ecology that contains all of them. Finally, and equally importantly, we don't see them across time. We see them in the narrow, immediate, overwhelming now, instead of surrounded by the yesterdays and tomorrows that may be a more important part of them than whatever is currently and obviously manifest. And we have to see in this way or be overwhelmed. When we look at the world, we perceive only what is enough for our plans and actions to work and for us to get by. What we inhabit, then, is this enough. That is a radical, functional, unconscious simplification of the world. And it's almost impossible for us not to mistake it for the world itself. But the objects we see are not simply there in the world for our simple, direct perceiving. They exist in a complex, multidimensional relationship to one another, not as self-evidently separate, bounded, independent objects. We perceive not them, but their functional utility, and in doing so, we make them sufficiently simple for sufficient understanding. It is for this reason that we must be precise in our aim. Absent that, we drown in the complexity of the world. This is true even for our perceptions of ourselves, of our individual persons. We assume that we end at the surface of our skin because of the way that we perceive. But we can understand with a little thought the provisional nature of that boundary. We shift what is inside our skin, so to speak, as the context we inhabit changes. Even when we do something as apparently simple as picking up a screwdriver, our brain automatically adjusts what it considers body to include the tool. We can literally feel things with the end of the screwdriver. When we extend a hand holding the screwdriver, we automatically take the length of the ladder into account. We can probe nooks and crannies with its extended end and comprehend what we are exploring. Furthermore, we instantly regard the screwdriver we are holding as our screwdriver and get possessive about it. We do the same with the much more complex tools we use in much more complex situations. The cars we pilot instantaneously and automatically become ourselves. Because of this, when someone bangs his fist on our car's hood after we have irritated him at a crosswalk, we take it personally. This is not always reasonable. Nonetheless, without the extension of self into machine, it would be impossible to drive. The extensible boundaries of ourselves also expand to include other people, family members, lovers, and friends. A mother will sacrifice herself for her children. Is our father or son or wife or husband more or less integral to us than an arm or a leg? We can answer in part by asking, which would we rather lose? Which loss would we sacrifice more to avoid? We practice for such permanent extension, such permanent commitment, by identifying with the fictional characters of books and movies. Their tragedies and triumphs rapidly and convincingly become ours. Sitting still in our seats, we nonetheless act out a multitude of alternate realities, extending ourselves experimentally, testing multiple potential paths, before specifying the one we will actually take. Engrossed in a fictional world, we can even become things that don't really exist. In the blink of an eye, in the magic hall of a movie theater, we can become fantastical creatures. We sit in the dark before rapidly flickering images and become witches, superheroes, aliens, vampires, lions, elves, or wooden marionettes. We feel everything they feel and are peculiarly happy to pay for the privilege, even when what we experience is sorrow, fear, or horror. Something similar, but more extreme, happens when we identify not with a character in a fictional drama, but with a whole group in a competition. Think of what happens when a favorite team wins or loses an important game against an arch rival. The winning goal will bring the whole network of fans to their feet before they think in unscripted unison. It is as if their many nervous systems are directly wired to the game unfolding in front of them. Fans take the victories and defeats of their teams very personally, even wearing the jerseys of their heroes, often celebrating their wins and losses more than any such events that actually occur in their day-to-day lives. This identification manifests itself deeply, even biochemically and neurologically. Vicarious experiences of winning and losing, for example, raise and lower testosterone levels among fans participating in the contest. Our capacity for identification is something that manifests itself at every level of our being. To the degree that we are patriotic, similarly, our country is not just important to us. It is us. We might even sacrifice our entire smaller individual selves in battle to maintain the integrity of our country. For much of history, such willingness to die has been regarded as something admirable and courageous, as a part of human duty. Paradoxically, that is a direct consequence not of our aggression, but of our extreme sociability and willingness to cooperate. If we can become not only ourselves, but our families, teams, and countries, cooperation comes easily to us, relying on the same deeply innate mechanisms that drive us and other creatures to protect our very bodies. The world is simple only when it behaves. It is very difficult to make sense of the interconnected chaos of reality just by looking at it. It's a very complicated act, requiring perhaps half our brains. Everything shifts and changes in the real world. Each hypothetically separate thing is made up of smaller hypothetically separate things and is simultaneously part of larger hypothetically separate things. The boundaries between the levels and between different things themselves at a given level are neither clear nor self-evident objectively. They must be established practically, pragmatically, and they retain their validity only under very narrow and specified conditions. The conscious illusion of complete and sufficient perception only sustains itself, for example, only remains sufficient for our purposes, when everything goes according to plan. Under such circumstances, what we see is accurate enough, so that there is no utility in looking farther. To drive successfully, we don't have to understand or even perceive the complex machinery of our automobiles. The hidden complexities of our private cars only intrude on our consciousness when that machinery fails, or when we collide unexpectedly with something, or something with us. Even in the case of mere mechanical failure, to say nothing of a serious accident, such intrusion is always felt, at least initially, as anxiety-provoking. That's a consequence of emergent uncertainty. A car, as we perceive it, is not a thing or an object. It is instead something that takes us somewhere we want to go. It is only when it stops taking us and going, in fact, that we perceive it much at all. It is only when a car quits suddenly or is involved in an accident and must be pulled over to the side of the road that we are forced to apprehend and analyze the myriad of parts that car as thing that goes depends on. When our car fails, our incompetence with regards to its complexity is instantly revealed. That has practical consequences. We don't get to go where we were going, as well as psychological. Our peace of mind disappears along with our functioning vehicle. We must generally turn to the experts who inhabit garages and workshops to restore both functionality to our vehicle and simplicity to our perceptions. That's mechanic as psychologist. It is precisely then that we can understand, although we seldom deeply consider, the staggeringly low-resolution quality of our vision and the inadequacy of our corresponding understanding. In a crisis, when our thing no longer goes, we turn to those whose expertise far transcends ours to restore the match between our expectant desire and what actually happens. This all means that the failure of our car can also force us to confront the uncertainty of the broader social context, which is usually invisible to us, in which the machine and mechanic are mere parts. Betrayed by our car, we come up against all the things we don't know. Is it time for a new vehicle? Did I err in my original purchase? Is the mechanic competent, honest, and reliable? Is the garage he works for trustworthy? Sometimes, too, we must contemplate something worse, something broader and deeper. Have the roads now become too dangerous? Have I become, or always been, too incompetent, too scattered and inattentive, too old? The limitations of all our perceptions of things and selves manifest themselves when something we can usually depend on in our simplified world breaks down. Then the more complex world that was always there, invisible and conveniently ignored, makes its presence known. It is then that the walled garden we archetypally inhabit reveals its hidden but ever-present snakes. You and I are simple only when the world behaves. When things break down, what has been ignored rushes in. When things are no longer specified with precision, the walls crumble and chaos makes its presence known. When we've been careless and let things slide, what we have refused to attend to gathers itself up, adopts a serpentine form, and strikes, often at the worst possible moment. It is then that we see what focused intent, precision of aim, and careful attention protects us from. Imagine a loyal and honest wife suddenly confronted by evidence of her husband's infidelity. She has lived alongside him for years. She saw him as she assumes he is, reliable, hardworking, loving, dependable. In her marriage, she is standing on a rock, or so she believes. But he becomes less attentive and more distracted. He begins, in the cliched manner, to work longer hours. Small things she says and does irritate him unjustifiably. One day she sees him in a downtown cafe with another woman, interacting with her in a manner difficult to rationalize and ignore. The limitations and inaccuracy of her former perceptions become immediately and painfully obvious. Her theory of her husband collapses. What happens in consequence? First, something, someone, emerges in his stead, a complex, frightening stranger. That's bad enough. But it's only half the problem. Her theory of herself collapses, too, in the aftermath of the betrayal, so that it's not one stranger that's the problem. It's two. Her husband is not who she perceived him to be. But neither is she, the betrayed wife. She is no longer the well-loved, secure wife and valued partner. Strangely enough, despite our belief in the permanent immutability of the past, she may never have been. The past is not necessarily what it was, even though it has already been. The present is chaotic and indeterminate. The ground shifts continually around her feet and ours. Equally, the future, not yet here, changes into something it was not supposed to be. Is the once reasonably content wife now a deceived innocent or a gullible fool? Should she view herself as victim or as co-conspirator in a shared delusion? Her husband is what? An unsatisfied lover? A target of seduction? A psychopathic liar? The very devil himself? How could he be so cruel? How could anyone? What is this home she has been living in? How could she be so naive? How could anyone? She looks in the mirror. Who is she? What's going on? Are any of her relationships real? Have any of them ever been? What has happened to the future? Everything is up for grabs when the deeper realities of the world unexpectedly manifest themselves. Everything is intricate beyond imagining. Everything is affected by everything else. We perceive a very narrow slice of a causally interconnected matrix, although we strive with all our might to avoid being confronted by knowledge of that narrowness. The thin veneer of perceptual sufficiency cracks, however, when something fundamental goes wrong. The dreadful inadequacy of our senses reveals itself. Everything we hold dear crumbles to dust. We freeze. We turn to stone. What then do we see? Where can we look when it is precisely what we see that has been insufficient? What do we see when we don't know what we're looking at? What is it that is the world after the twin towers disintegrate? What, if anything, is left standing? What dread beast rises from the ruins when the invisible pillars supporting the world's financial system tremble and fall? What do we see when we are swept up in the fire and drama of a national socialist rally, or cower, paralyzed with fear, in the midst of a massacre in Rwanda? What is it that we see when we cannot understand what is happening to us, cannot determine where we are, know no longer who we are, and no longer understand what surrounds us. What we don't see is the well-known and comforting world of tools, of useful objects, of personalities. We don't even see familiar obstacles, sufficiently troubling though they are in normal times, already mastered, that we can simply step around. What we perceive when things fall apart is no longer the stage and settings of habitable order. It's the eternal, watery tohu vabohu, formless emptiness, and the teom, the abyss, to speak biblically, the chaos forever lurking beneath our thin surfaces of security. It's from that chaos that the holy word of God himself extracted order at the beginning of time, according to the oldest opinions expressed by mankind. And it is in the image of that same word that we were made, male and female, according to the same opinions. It's from that chaos that whatever stability we had the good fortune to experience emerged originally for some limited time when we first learned to perceive. It's chaos that we see when things fall apart, even though we cannot truly see it. What does all this mean? Emergency. Emergence. E. This is the sudden manifestation from somewhere unknown of some previously unknown phenomenon, from the Greek phainesthai, to shine forth. This is the reappearance of the eternal dragon from its eternal cavern, from its now disrupted slumber. This is the underworld, with its monsters rising from the depths. How do we prepare for an emergency, when we do not know what has emerged or from where? How do we prepare for catastrophe, when we do not know what to expect or how to act? We turn from our minds, so to speak, too slow, too ponderous, to our bodies. Our bodies react much faster than our minds. When things collapse around us, our perception disappears and we act. Ancient reflexive responses, rendered automatic and efficient over hundreds of millions of years, protect us in those dire moments when not only thought, but perception itself fails. Under such circumstances, our bodies ready themselves for all possible eventualities. First, we freeze. The reflexes of the body then shade into emotion, the next stage of perception. Is this something scary? Something useful? Something that must be fought? Something that can be ignored? How will we determine this? And when? We don't know. Now, we are in a costly and demanding state of readiness. Our bodies are flooded with cortisol and adrenaline. Our hearts beat faster. Our breath quickens. We realize painfully that our sense of competence and completeness is gone. It was just a dream. We draw on physical and psychological resources saved carefully for just this moment, if we are fortunate enough to have them. We prepare for the worst, or the best. We push the gas pedal furiously to the floor and slam on the brakes at the same time. We scream or laugh. We look disgusted or terrified. We cry. And then we begin to parse apart the chaos. And so the deceived wife, increasingly unhinged, feels the motivation to reveal all to herself, her sister, her best friend, to a stranger on a bus, or retreats into silence and ruminates obsessively to the same end. What went wrong? What did she do that was so unforgivable? Who is this person she's been living with? What kind of world is this where such things can happen? What kind of God would make such a place? What conversation could she possibly initiate with this new, infuriating person inhabiting the shell of her former husband? What forms of revenge might satisfy her anger? Who could she seduce in return for this insult? She is, by turns, enraged, terrified, struck down by pain, and exhilarated by the possibilities of her newfound freedom. Her last place of bedrock security was in fact not stable, not certain, not bedrock at all. Her house was built on a foundation of sand. The ice she was skating on was simply too thin. She fell through into the water below and is drowning. She has been hit so hard that her anger, terror, and grief consume her. Her sense of betrayal widens until the whole world caves in. Where is she? In the underworld, with all its terrors. How did she get there? This experience, this voyage into the substructure of things, this is all perception, too, in its nascent form, this preparation, this consideration of what might have been and what could still be, this emotion and fantasy. This is all the deep perception now necessary before the familiar objects that she once knew reappear, if they ever do, in their simplified and comfortable form. This is perception before the chaos of possibility is re-articulated into the functional realities of order. Was it really so unexpected? She asks herself. She asks others, thinking back. Should she now feel guilty about ignoring the warning signs, subtle though they may have been, encouraged though she was to avoid them? She remembers when she first married, eagerly joining her husband every single night to make love. Perhaps that was too much to expect or even too much to cope with, but once in the last 6 months? Once every 2 or 3 months for years before that? Would anyone she could truly respect, including herself, put up with such a situation? There is a story for children. There's No Such Thing as a Dragon by Jack Kent that I really like. It's a very simple tale, at least on the surface. I once read its few pages to a group of retired University of Toronto alumni and explained its symbolic meaning. It's about a small boy, Billy Bixby, who spies a dragon sitting on his bed one morning. It's about the size of a house cat, and friendly. He tells his mother about it, but she tells him that there's no such thing as a dragon. So it starts to grow. It eats all of Billy's pancakes. Soon it fills the whole house. Mum tries to vacuum, but she has to go in and out of the house through the windows because of the dragon everywhere. It takes her forever. Then the dragon runs off with the house. Billy's dad comes home, and there's just an empty space where he used to live. The mailman tells him where the house went. He chases after it, climbs up the dragon's head and neck, now sprawling out into the street, and rejoins his wife and son. Mum still insists that the dragon does not exist, but Billy, who's pretty much had it by now, insists, "There is a dragon, Mum." Instantly, it starts to shrink. Soon, it's cat-sized again. Everyone agrees that dragons of that size, number one, exist, and number two, are much preferable to their gigantic counterparts. Mum, eyes reluctantly opened by this point, asks somewhat plaintively why it had to get so big. Billy quietly suggests, maybe it wanted to be noticed. Maybe. That's the moral of many, many stories. Chaos emerges in a household, bit by bit. Mutual unhappiness and resentment pile up. Everything untidy is swept under the rug, where the dragon feasts on the crumbs. But no one says anything, as the shared society and negotiated order of the household reveals itself as inadequate, or disintegrates in the face of the unexpected and threatening. Everybody whistles in the dark instead. Communication would require admission of terrible emotions, resentment, terror, loneliness, despair, jealousy, frustration, hatred, boredom. Moment by moment, it's easier to keep the peace. But in the background, in Billy Bixby's house and in all that are like it, dragon grows. One day it bursts forth in a form that no one can ignore. It lifts the very household from its foundations. Then it's an affair or a decades-long custody dispute of ruinous economic and psychological proportions. Then it's the concentrated version of the acrimony that could have been spread out tolerably issue by issue over the years of the pseudo-paradise of the marriage. Every one of the 300,000 unrevealed issues which have been lied about, avoided, rationalized away, hidden like an army of skeletons in some great horrific closet, bursts forth like Noah's flood, drowning everything. There's no ark, because no one built one, even though everyone felt the storm gathering. Don't ever underestimate the destructive power of sins of omission. Maybe the demolished couple could have had a conversation, or two, or 200, about their sex lives. Maybe the physical intimacy they undoubtedly shared should have been matched, as it often is not, by a corresponding psychological intimacy. Maybe they could have fought through their roles. In many households in recent decades,